From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Jake Gyllenhaal. He stars in the new film Southpaw as a boxer named Billy Hope.
I believe Billy to be inarticulate outside of the ring. I sort of made a rule for myself that my mouth would not open more than like a quarter of an inch, you know, and if I smiled, it would hurt.
Gyllenhaal, who grew up in a movie family, also starred in Brokeback Mountain, End of Watch, Nightcrawler, and Donnie Darko, about a high school boy who is either mentally unraveling or foreseeing the end of the world.
I was a bit of a mess as a kid that age, and I read it and I went, wow, this is really what I'm feeling.
Well, you said you were a bit of a mess. What do you mean?
Well, I mean I was an adolescent.
Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissued box set of Thelonious Monk's Riverside recordings. That's coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jake Gyllenhaal, stars as a boxer in the new film Southpaw. He also starred in the films Nightcrawler, End of Watch, Jarhead, Zodiac, and Brokeback Mountain. He was first noticed in his starring role in the 2001 film Donnie Darko, playing a troubled high school student. He was 10 when he made his screen debut, playing Billy Crystal's son in the film City Slickers. He grew up surrounded by movie people because his father, Steven, is a film director and his mother, Naomi, is a screenwriter. His older sister, well, she's Maggie Gyllenhaal. She actually played his older sister in Donnie Darko. In the new film Southpaw, directed by Antoine Fuqua, Jake Gyllenhaal plays boxer Billy Hope, an orphan who was raised in the foster care system and is now married and has a daughter. After winning the light heavyweight title, his wife suggests that it's time to stop because he's been taking too many punches to his face and body. He's prepared to follow her advice, but after a tragedy that results in him losing everything, he has to get back in the ring and try to make a comeback. Here he is, early in the film, taking questions at a press conference after winning the championship.
Billy, most of us here had you winning this early. Were you expecting such a difficult fight?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. You can't expect anything. I was really looking forward to just showing up, walking in the ring, and then having him fall on the ground.
Billy.
No, man, I mean, I expected a hard fight, you know. Put my family through a lot. By the way, Layla, if you're watching, go to sleep, baby.
Jake Gyllenhaal, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
You said you didn't follow boxing before getting the part in Southpaw. So how did you get the part and why did you want it?
Yeah, I wasn't an avid boxing fan. I mean, I grew up in the 90s, so Tyson was obviously a staple of my upbringing, Mike Tyson. So I don't think you could really be breathing and not be a fan of his during that time. But I really didn't know much about it. And I think really the script was about a father and a daughter. It was about family and about a man really learning how to become a father, someone who had grown up in the foster care system and was an orphan, never really had a parent himself. His wife he met in the foster care system, and they had a child relatively young. And through a series of circumstances in his life, has to learn how to parent this child. And so that to me is what the movie was about. And the boxing was secondary. You know, I didn't know how to box when I started. And I knew in order to play a boxer and the way that Antoine Fuqua was going to shoot the movie, he said he was going to shoot it like a real HBO Showtime fight. So there would be no doubles and we would be seeing my whole body move and there wouldn't be any room to fake anything. I knew I had to actually learn how to box. But it was all motivated by the story that I fell in love with, which was really about a father and a daughter.
So you have a very developed body in this movie. I mean, it's all muscle and it's all like well-formed muscle. What did you do to develop that?
I thought you were talking figuratively initially. So I was a well-formed body, and then I thought you were going to say of work, but no, yes.
Body.
A well-formed body, it's true.
Well-formed body of body.
Well, I spent 5 months learning how to box. So over those 5 months, as I started to become more fluent in the language of boxing, you know, what happens is you learn combinations or you learn offensive, defensive moves, and then you're, you know, you need your mind to be able to translate itself through your body. And so as you learn more, you need to be in better shape. And so over 5 months, you know, slowly sort of chipped away at it and gotten very, very, very good physical shape in order to kind of translate what had been taught to me skill-wise.
So unlike a costume, you don't take your body off when you come home. What was it like to have a different body?
Well, boxers are very much their body. That was an odd thing to sort of translate to myself. I mean, to be confident there, you know, you basically walk into a ring half naked, you know, and it's very primal in that way. It's all about a certain confidence. You know, even the choice, I have a tattoo on the back. You know, Billy Hope has this tattoo that says, "Fear no man," in the biggest block letters I've ever seen. And I really hesitated initially to put that on my back. You know, it was a last-minute choice. And I think going home and having that, you know, through essentially the 7 months of preparation for the movie and the shooting of the film, there's a confidence that comes from that. And more than that, in terms of how you look on the outside, I think my feelings about my endurance and my own strength and confidence, you know, it was life-changing, to be honest. I mean, I felt like sort of more confident internally than I had in my whole life. And that was not just due to the physical stuff. It was really due to learning boxing and knowing that I could defend myself if I needed to.
Is that something you felt you didn't know before?
Yeah, I had been in fights in high school and unfortunately did not come out the victor. So I that was something that was new to me.
Well, for the movie, you had to learn how to take punches on screen because your character is not famous for his defense. He's very good at channeling his anger and winning on that. So during the course of the film, you take a lot of punches. Your face is swollen and bloodied during parts of the film. How do you learn how to take punches without really getting hurt when you're filming?
Well, you know, in terms of getting hit, you know, I think that's inevitable. And it's hard to play a boxer in a movie and not know what that feels like and not actually take a punch or give a punch. You know, to me, when you're playing a character, it's essentially, you know, or watch or experience the feeling of, in one way or another, where it's whether it's directly or indirectly, the feeling of what your character might be going through somewhere in the real world. And so it doesn't feel great. You know, I wouldn't recommend it, and I don't like getting hit, but it was important for the movie.
At least
that's how I justify it when I would get hit. That was good for the movie.
But you have to defend your face in real life. Your face is part of your tool, you know, as an actor.
Right.
So, like, you don't want to have that kind of permanently swollen eye that some boxers end up with.
Right. Well, yeah. No, you don't. But I also feel like there's a preciousness to actors. There's a vanity that I definitely participate in, but I also don't necessarily agree with. So I like to challenge that, you know, and I think acting is as much of a serious job, and I take it incredibly seriously, and I find it actually important, though I know that's a presumptuous word to use. But I also find it absurd. And so somewhere in the in-between, between the importance and the absurdity of it, I think it's okay to let that stuff go. You know, sometimes those hits, you know, actually make a career better, as in sometimes those injuries do. And I don't really necessarily believe in the vanity of it.
What was the worst punch that you took?
I would actually say I say body shots. I mean, I took a lot of shots in the jaw. We would talk a lot in the ring. We'd improvise a lot of the fighting. We'd move around. Our hands would be up over our faces, you know, in protection. And the fighter opposite me and I, we would talk. So I'd say, okay, I'm going to throw two jabs in the left hand, you know. And then they say, okay, I'm going to slip that. I'm going to block one jab, get hit by one, and slip the right. Okay, you ready? Yeah, okay. We try it, and we do it again. And while you're talking, sometimes you would forget that you had just said, okay, let's go, and you'd get hit, you know. So my jaw, you know, got knocked around. But really it's the body shots that hurt the most, I would say.
Your voice is different in the film than it is in conversation. Can you talk about what you did with your voice?
Well, I believe in resistance a lot of times, particularly with characters, whether in the scene or in your body. You know, sometimes I think wearing a shirt that's uncomfortable or too tight for you or too big for you or whatever it might be, given the choices of the character and the history of a character, is really helpful. And so, you know, I believe Billy to be inarticulate outside of the ring, articulate physically but not verbally. I also believe that he was really fueled by testosterone and, you know, that type of aggression. I think that kind of deepens the voice, and I think particularly Billy slows down the way he speaks because I don't think his brain was ever taught, was never in a place where he had to defend himself verbally. So I tried to just create resistances. I thought also he was very sensitive to light, not only from being punched, but just because I always considered him pretty infantile in the first half of the movie in particular. And I think infants are not articulate and also and also very sensitive to light and many other things. And I considered him to be that, this sort of brute animal, but also this child. And so all those things came into play.
So what did you do physically for the resistance that you're talking about?
Well, they're prosthetics. You know, I have prosthetics on my face, and more than just showing the history of his face, I really wanted to have a difficulty opening my eyes and looking around. And I sort of made a rule for myself that my mouth would not be allowed to open more than like a quarter of an inch, you know, and if I smiled, it would hurt, you know. And and so over time, those become character traits, you know. I try and do that throughout preparation. And I also found that wearing a mouth guard while you're training and fighting, and if you spent most of your time doing that, you know, you have to lock your jaw a lot when you're fighting. You know, when you're training, you're sparring or even in a fight, you know, you shouldn't be talking like I told you before when I hurt my jaw. You should have your teeth, you know, clenched because you're going to get hit. So I thought that Billy really didn't know how to do that outside the ring either. So very often that was what made him feel comfortable. It was almost like he had a mouthpiece in all the time.
So we've been talking about Southpaw, in which you play a kind of inarticulate boxer. And the movie you made before that, in 2014, Nightcrawler, was a very different character in the sense that, like, you really pumped your body up for Southpaw, and you actually got a more, like, hollowed out look. Not outlook, but hollowed out look for Nightcrawler. kind of gaunt. Your eyes are, like, recessed and, like, kind of dark around. Dark around them. So I want to play a clip from Nightcrawler before we talk about it. You play when the film starts, you're a small-time criminal who's got nothing. You do have access to the internet, and you've read a lot of self-improvement stuff on the internet, and you tend to insert self-improvement quotes into all of your conversations. In the film, you eventually become a freelance cameraman who specializes in getting to crime scenes and car accidents and shooting graphic video for the kind of local TV news shows that program with the motto, "If it bleeds, it leads." But in the opening scene, you're just like a small-time criminal, and you've been cutting chain-link fences and stealing the fence just to sell for scrap metal. You've stolen manhole covers and copper to sell to scrap metal yards. And in this scene, you've been trying to sell the metals that you've stolen to the scrap metal guy, and you've been asking for a higher price than he's willing to pay. And so here you are making the final negotiation.
I'm willing to take less to establish a business relationship. If that's your last best offer, then I guess I accept.
All right, drive around back and unload them.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a job. In fact, I've made up my mind to find a career that I can learn and grow into. Who am I? I'm a hard worker. I set high goals, and I've been told that I'm persistent. Now, I'm not fooling myself, sir. Having been raised with the self-esteem movement so popular in schools, I used to expect my needs to be considered. But I know that today's work culture no longer caters to the job loyalty that could be promised to earlier generations. What I believe, sir, is that good things come to those who work their asses off, and that people such as yourself who reached the top of the mountain didn't just fall there. My motto is, if you want to win the lottery, you have to make the money to buy a ticket. Did I say that I worked in a garage? So what do you say? I could start tomorrow, or even why not tonight?
No.
How about an internship, then? A lot of young people are taking unpaid positions to get a foot in the door. That's something I'd be willing to do.
I'm not hiring a thief.
That's my guest, Jake Gyllenhaal, in a scene from Nightcrawler. I just love you in that because, like, you're doing your lines as if your character has, like, memorized these things and can just, like, pull out these quotes as needed to recite, which seems exactly right to me. Memorizing lines about today's work culture and calling the scrap metal guy a guy who's made it to the top of the mountain.
Yep. The brilliant words of Dan Gilroy.
So can you tell us how you developed your voice for this role? And I just don't mean the placement of your voice, but like the whole affect that you're going for.
Well, I figured the only way we were going to have a hour and a half long movie and not a 3 hour long movie with all the soliloquies that this character gives was if he had speed, number one. And number two, I think I tried to memorize all of them as fast as I could. You know, we didn't have a lot of time when we were shooting the film. I knew we wouldn't. We shot the movie in 22 days. And I figured, you know, I would need to have some pace on them. And I also figured in terms of selling, you need to move quick. You know, people aren't going to listen for very long and you need to get a lot of information out very quickly. So I memorized them at breakneck speed. I had to sort of slow them down actually when we were shooting because sometimes they were too fast. I mean, I can recite that speech even now.
Oh, do it.
as fast as I can.
Yeah.
I can. Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a job. In fact, I made up my mind to find a career that I can learn and grow into. Who am I? I'm a hard worker. I set high goals, and I've been told that I'm persistent. I'm not fooling myself, sir. Having been raised with the self-esteem movement so popular in schools, I used to expect my needs to be considered. But I know that today's work culture no longer caters to the job loyalty that could be promised to earlier generations. What I believe, sir, is that good things come to those who work their asses off. And, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Bravo. But that's great. But I love that because this is a person who doesn't have genuine feelings. He knows yes. what a feeling is supposed to sound like when it's expressed. So he memorizes things that sound like they're expressing feelings, but he's never really expressing anything. You know what I mean?
No, there are these moments.
He doesn't feel any genuine emotion.
No.
Outside of anger. Yeah.
I don't mean to laugh at that. I just there is sort of a funny thing when Dan Gilroy would come to me. There's a scene with Rene Russo, who's brilliant in the movie, where he tells her why he wants to work in television news. And the direction that Dan gave me was, ask her to marry you. And it has nothing to do with marriage in any way, but from this speech, he said, like, give it like you were going to ask her to marry you. And it's all about how he wants to be in the local television news business. And somehow there's this sort of strange fake emotion underneath it that he knows nothing about. And in a weird way, neither did I while I was doing it. I was just saying these words and trying to give them a feeling. And I think that's kind of what Lou is about, is just picking up these feelings he sees other people have and then translating them into things he's picked up off the internet.
Did you end up reading self-improvement books just to get into his mindset?
I only read self-improvement.
No, I'm sure.
That I'm actually
That's
reading a great one
to
right
where
now.
You are today.
Yeah, I mean they will change your life. I listen to a lot of those self-improvement tapes because he listens to them at the beginning of the movie. You can kind of hear them early on, but really I really use the screenplay in the case of that movie as my Bible. You know, there's rarely dialogue like that nowadays. And I never veered from a period. I never veered from a comma. I never improvised anything in the movie. You know, sometimes there are just those characters and there are just those that type of writing that you just must obey. And I did. And so I didn't really look outside there. It was all in the words. I did go with the guys who do the job that Lou Bloom does, and I had done a movie a few years before Nightcrawler called End of Watch about two police officers in Southeast LA.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent 5 months on the streets with police officers preparing for that and saw so many things.
Did you see things from a different angle driving around with the police in LA as research for End of Watch than you saw things when you were driving around with TV news cameramen?
Yeah. I mean, in the case of working with police officers and the incredible, you know, LAPD police officers that I worked with, you know, I saw death. I saw really the hardest sides of humanity there and saw how extraordinary the work of police officers can be. And I think sometimes, maybe rightfully so, they've gotten a hard time and been given a hard time and constantly do. But I was amazed at the work that I saw. And, you know, I wasn't going on a ride-along, you know, like you would go on a few ride-alongs. I spent months and months with four or five different sets of partners in both the Sheriff's Department and Los Angeles Police Department. And it changed my life. So it was an interesting evolution from End of Watch to Nightcrawler.
My guest is Jake Gyllenhaal. He stars as a boxer in the new film Southpaw. After we take a short break, we'll talk about growing up in a movie family and getting his first role at the age of 10, playing Billy Crystal's son in City Slickers. And jazz critic Evan Whitehead will review a reissued box set of Thelonious Monk's Riverside recordings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Vonage. In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service, making it better. After such an achievement, who would have blamed Vonage if they said, "Enjoy better, people, we'll be by the pool." But the thing about better is, there's always more better. So today, Vonage is not by the pool, but is back to work transforming communications for business by making it better with award-winning cloud-based solutions. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
So you were kind of born into a movie family. Your father, Stephen Gyllenhaal, is a director. Your mother, Naomi Foner Gyllenhaal, is a screenwriter. They're divorced now, but they were together when you were growing up. You were 10 years old when you got your first movie role. That was as Billy Crystal's son in the film City Slickers, which I confess I haven't seen.
What, Terry?
Yeah, sorry. How did you get the part?
Yeah. I remember I went to some sort of party, I think, with my parents, and Billy Crystal was there, and he saw me, and he said, you know, will he come in and not read for this movie I have? You know, he's funny, and I guess I must have been acting out as I... If you spent more time with me in real life, you would see I like to act out. And so I was making some fool out of myself. And I think I remember what happened was he was leaving and I knew who he was. And I picked up a chair from the table and I said, "Here, take this. This is your party favor."
What?
And, yeah, that's just me. It doesn't make much sense. But he loved it and he thought it was really funny.
So apparently once you got that role in City Slickers, you wanted to act more. You auditioned for other roles, and your parents let you audition, but they wouldn't let you actually take a job if you got the part. So mm-hmm.
Yep.
What was the philosophy behind that?
They believed in education over everything else. And they said, you know, you're about to start junior high school. It's a really, really important time in your life, though you probably can't see that now. And we believe that you need to go to school. And I thank them so much for that.
Because
it only gave me more drive. You know, it only made me say, well, when I get older, I'm really going to try and do this because I really like doing it. And because I have an education. Because when I read a screenplay or when I read a book or there's something that I want to make into a story, I have had the privilege of reading the great books and reading the great minds and using my own mind to interpret them. And because of that, it's given me an opportunity to find and believe in projects like Nightcrawler, you know, or Southpaw, where I say, you know, I've seen this story, but how can we do it differently?
The first role I think that really put you on the map was Donnie Darko. Hmm. And you play a high school student who starts seeing this kind of giant rabbit that talks to him, a kind of imaginary friend. And he thinks, Donnie Darko thinks he's being given secret information about the impending end of the world. And we're not sure if he actually has access to secret information or if it's a psychiatric issue that's been mm-hmm. aggravated because he doesn't always take his pills. So I just want to play a short scene. And here you are with your psychiatrist, and you're talking to her about a very old kind of disheveled woman named Roberta Sparrow, who most of the kids in the neighborhood are kind of scared of her. But recently you saw her walking kind of addled in the middle of the road, and you tried to help her. She whispered something in your ear, and this has to do with the whole end-of-the-world scenario that you think that you're getting. So here you are talking to your psychiatrist about this old woman, Roberta Sparrow.
She was just standing there in the middle of the road, frozen. So I got out of the car, and I walked over to see if she was okay. And she leaned over and whispered in my ear.
What did she say?
I mean, I think Frank wants me to go talk to her, you know, because the last time I saw him, he asked me if I knew about time travel, and she wrote a book about it, so there can't be, like, a coincidence, right?
Donnie, what did Roberta Sparrow say to you?
She said that every living creature on Earth dies alone.
How did that make you feel?
It reminded me of my dog, Callie. She died when I was 8, and she crawled underneath the porch.
To die.
To be alone.
Do you feel alone right now?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to believe I'm not, but I've just never seen any proof, so I just don't debate it anymore, you know? It's like I could spend my whole life debating it over and over again, weighing the pros and cons, and in the end, I still wouldn't have any proof, so I just don't debate it anymore. It's absurd.
The search for God is absurd?
It is if everyone dies alone.
Does that scare you?
I don't want to be alone.
That's my guest, Jake Gyllenhaal, in a scene from Donnie Darko. What impact did this movie have on your life? How old were you when you made it?
I was 19 or 20. Yeah.
And were you in college at that point?
I had dropped out of college, actually. I did 2 years of college, and then I went and started working pretty consistently. So, for all this talk of education, I am a college dropout, but I am also full of contradictions. So, but I remember, and that's part of it. You know, I was at Columbia, which is an extraordinary school in New York City, and I think I was searching for this creative outlet. I didn't really know at the time that's what I was searching for. And I was going through at 19, you know, this – eventually my parents got divorced, but there was a lot of things going on there. And I think I was just sort of trying to figure out what it was like to be an adult and what being an adult was. And when I read that script, I remember very clearly – thinking, wow, because it was at the time when all of those movies about, you know, high school movies and the movies about high school were about who was going to go to the prom or, you know, who was going to go to the party and get accepted in the cool kids club. And this was
how
a
you were
going
to lose your virginity.
Exactly. Yeah. And And this was a movie about high school, but it was about the internal ride that is adolescence. And I was a bit of a mess as a kid that age, and I read it and I went, wow, this is really what I'm feeling, more so than just more so than just like, I hope I can go to the popular kids' party.
Well, you said you were a bit of a mess. What do you mean?
Well, I mean I was an adolescent. I mean, you know, I think it's that age where you're moving in, you're moving out of a life that's protected and safe into a world that is the reality of the world with all the things that come with it, and I think things become more scary and a little bit more dangerous and more fun and exciting, and trying to navigate through those things are all, you know, what being an adolescent, sort of trying to figure out what that is into adulthood, is about.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jake Gyllenhaal, and he's now starring in the new film Southpaw. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this episode of Fresh Air comes from Citrix GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings. They want you to know that with Citrix GoToMeeting, you can collaborate and get work done even if your team is stuck at home. You can meet from any computer or mobile device, share screens to collaborate in real time, and turn on webcams to see each other in HD video. Right now, Citrix is offering a 30-day free trial at gotomeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button to get started.
Let's go back to 2005 when Brokeback Mountain was released, and you and Heath Ledger played two men who fall in love one summer while tending sheep on Brokeback Mountain in Wyoming. But they each marry women and have children. Once a year, they return to Brokeback Mountain together. But this relationship is kept very, very secret. This scene takes place 20 years into their relationship at the end of one of their visits. It ends up being the last time they see each other. Your character speaks first.
Yeah, we'll try this one. And I'll say it just once.
Go ahead.
Tell you what, we could have had a good life together. Real good life. Had us a place of our own. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain. Everything's built on that. That's all we got, boy. F***ing all. So I hope you know that if you don't never know the rest.
Got it.
You count the damn few times that we have been together in nearly 20 years, and you measure the short leash you keep me on, and then you ask me about Mexico, and you tell me you kill me for needing something I don't hardly never get. You have no idea how bad it gets. And I'm not you. I can't make it on a couple of high altitude once or twice a year? You are too much for me, Ennis. You sound like a horse and bitch. I wish I knew how to quit you.
Then why don't you just let me be, huh? It's because of you, Jack, that I'm like this. Nothing. I'm nowhere. Oh.
It's a scene from Brokeback Mountain in 2005 with Heath Ledger and my guest, Jake Gyllenhaal. When you made that scene, did you think, I wish I knew how to quit you would become a famous line?
I mean, no, not in any form, anywhere in my mind. All I could think about was the love between these two people, mm-hmm. you know, and it has since become something, you know, praised and mocked and mm-hmm. many other mm-hmm. things. And it's very interesting.
So can I ask you a question that I'm not sure you can be honest about? The music that swells up at the end of the scene that we played, I'm going to be honest, it bothers me because I think we know how we should feel hearing that. The emotion is being very clearly expressed. It's a very emotional
yes.
scene. I feel like we don't need that kind of, isn't it sad music to cue us about the emotions being expressed.
Well, I didn't direct the movie, so I don't...
I know that. But I wonder,
yeah,
as the actor who's like doing your best to convey this very like deeply felt... emotion, and Heath Ledger is trying to convey this very, very like repressed emotion. Listening back to you to it, can I ask you honestly if you ever wish that there wasn't music? I'm sorry. I feel like I'm putting you on the spot.
No, are you kidding me? No, I mean, I would point out. I preface this by saying this is an Academy Award winning score, but I would say that I often feel like it's interesting in films because, you know, I think people feel manipulated in films sometimes. I often hear that, particularly with music, where they say stuff like, oh, I feel like we're being told how to feel here, or this is what I'm supposed to feel. And I think that's true. I think the experience of a movie should be your own experience. And I don't think you should be forced into any feeling. And I think whatever feeling you have about it is important. Particularly with something like Brokeback Mountain, it's like I respect just as much the naysayers as I do the people who support the film. I respect their opinion. You know, and I love that about art in general. I mean, people have come up to me many times in my career and said just openly, like, I just didn't like you or that film, you know. And I go, man, like, thank you for that expression. I mean, and it's not done in a way that's – prefer it not to be, like, aggressive. But I love the expression of that, whatever it might be. And with music in movies – I think sometimes people can feel that way. For me, listening to it brings me back to, you know, brings me back to thinking about doing that scene with Heath, you know, and the honor it was to work with him and the beauty of his work. And I miss him as a human being, and I miss working with him. And what an unfortunate thing it is that we won't be able to see the beauty of his expression. And you know, hearing those things really gets you. And so I didn't hear the music as much, to be honest. I just thought about the feeling.
This might be too personal, so you just tell me, because I don't want to intrude.
Yeah.
Was Heath Ledger the first peer, the first friend you were close with who died?
Yeah.
I just think it's different, you know, when somebody your age, someone who you've worked with, one of your contemporaries who you're close to dies. It's just different from other deaths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was an incredibly special, and that doesn't even come close to encapsulating who he is, who he was. It is different. I think, you know, as an actor, like I said, we started talking earlier, about, you know, vanity and living in a sort of bubble. You know, I think sometimes reality doesn't, you don't always get a sense of that. And I think that's a proper criticism of the entertainment industry. And I think that's why I like to go off and I like to try and get into worlds that will wake me up. And when you say, do you like getting punched? Like, I don't like getting punched, but I don't think like, ooh, you know, maybe this is going to be not good for the next thing. I'm trying to be present where I am. I'm trying to have relationships that are as real as they possibly can be on a movie set. Be close to people because I know that it's precious. And I know not only like can that this career end in a very short period of time and this or that can happen, but also that life is precious. And and I think losing Heath and being a part of a family that was something like that movie we all made together, you know, makes you see that, makes you appreciate that, and hopefully moves you away from the things that really don't matter to the things that do.
Jake Gyllenhaal, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's really been an honor, so thanks, Terry.
Jake Gyllenhaal stars in the new movie Southpaw.
This episode of Fresh Air is supported by Trunk Club, a men's outfitting service. Trunk Club is designed for guys who don't have the time or desire to go shopping. After signing up, you'll be matched with your own personal stylist who, after getting to know your preferences, will handpick a selection of premium clothing, pack it in a trunk, and ship it all straight to your door. You'll have 10 days to try everything on. Keep what you love and send the rest back. You only pay for what you keep, and shipping is free both ways. Get started at trunkclub.com/freshair.
An acclaimed 1980s box set of the complete Riverside recordings of pianist Thelonious Monk has been reissued for the second time. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's really the story of two men, Monk and record producer Oren Keepnews, who died in March. Here's Kevin's review.
Thelonious Monk's Brilliant Corners from 1956 with Max Roach on drums. It's in a new miniaturized version of a grand old box of Monk's complete Riverside recordings. His producer at the label, Oren Keepnews, was a longtime admirer. He was also a good writer who in his lengthy notes explains what he and Monk were up to in the late 50s. To make that composer and elliptical pianist more accessible, Keepnews suggested Monk record two LPs of standards, starting with an all-Ellington program. It underscored the spare, percussive piano tradition Duke and Monk shared. On Mood Indigo. Thelonious Monk and Oren Keepnews got together at an opportune time. In 1957, saxophonist John Coltrane joined Monk's band to their mutual fame and benefit. They had the attraction of opposites. The pianist left holes in the music, and Coltrane eagerly filled them up. This is one of Monk's trickiest pieces, Trinkle Tinkle. Riverside didn't get to record Monk and Coltrane live during their celebrated run at the Five Spot Club. There were contractual difficulties. But that summer of 1957, producer Keepnews put Monk and his friend baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan together with the Five Spot rhythm section, Wilbur Ware on bass and Shadow Wilson on drums. As ever, Monk's playing behind a soloist can sound more like sabotage than support. But Mulligan was into it. Jerry Mulligan on I Mean You. At Riverside, Monk recorded 15 CDs worth of material in trios, quartets, quintets, sextets, and a septet, all with barely a misstep and more notable players than we can mention. Orrin Keepnews didn't come up with the idea for Monk's 10-piece Little Big Band, but he was at Town Hall to record their concert. For Little Rudy Tootie, arranger Hall Overton took Monk's piano solo from an earlier version and harmonized it for seven horns. After the Coltrane Quartet and the Town Hall Big Band, Thelonious Monk's star was rising. When his second Riverside contract was up in 1961, he jumped to big money Columbia Records. That label would get him on the cover of Time magazine, but would mostly record his quartet over and over. To finish out his old contract, Riverside issued a 1961 Italian concert by that same quartet with Charlie Rouse on saxophone, a preview of years to come. That concert was part of a six-week European tour, Monk's first of many. It was another sign he'd finally hit the big time. His years at Riverside had gotten him over the hump.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Thelonious Monk, the complete Riverside recordings, which has been reissued for the second time. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, a follow-up to our discussion about upspeak and vocal fry. Young men and women, particularly women, who have those vocal characteristics, are often accused of sounding irritating, uncertain, and lacking in authority. What's going on? We'll talk with a linguist who studies language and gender, a speech and language pathologist, and a journalist who's been criticized for her voice. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.